You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
We believe she is a trailblazer in the city of Overland Park. If I'm not mistaken, the first female police chief for the city of Overland Park. And she is joining us in studio, Doreen Jokerst. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chief.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
So we have Chief Graves. Lenexa, I believe, has a new female police chief, and I believe you are the first in the history of Overland Park. Welcome, and how does it feel?
It feels great. I've been here approximately 10 days. I've been on the job for approximately 3, and it has been wonderful. Everyone has been great. They've allowed, you know, patience and grace with this transition, and everyone has been welcoming and really providing an inclusive, warm environment for me to step into.
Everybody's telling you where to go, where to eat barbecue.
Yes.
What to go see. And you've only been here for 10 days and on the job for 3. And you're already doing your first radio interview.
That's right. That's right. Yes. And I've been to different, everyone has their favorites, I can tell, barbecue restaurants.
Yeah.
And I've been to a few of them, and I have a few more on my list to go to, but they have all been phenomenal.
So what is on your list and where do you begin? You come to us from Colorado. You've spent your entire life in public safety. I want to start, if you have young people in the audience, I think this is important. I want to start with your background. Way before you were the chief in Colorado, how you got started as a young woman, as a young girl, really, in public safety.
Yeah, so I can tell you. So my family and I, to go back in time a little bit, my family and I, when I was 8, went to San Francisco because everyone has that fun aunt. My aunt lived in San Francisco and we toured Alcatraz. And during that tour, I said, I love this. And I looked at my parents and I remember it to this day. And I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be a police officer. My dad was retired from the Air Force. We didn't have policing in our family. And they said, okay. Fast forward to the age of 14, we received a letter in the mail from our local police department that said, we're going to start an Explorer program. And so my parents hit me up and said, hey, this would be a great opportunity for you. And at the age of 14 years old, I started serving in a volunteer capacity at our local police department. I served there for 7 years until I entered the police academy at the age of 20. And it was the police department I worked at for 20 years after that, rising through the rank of commander. And so when I looked at the Overland Park Police Department, one of the things I looked up is they have an Explorer program, a way to engage our youth, to get them into public safety, to let them learn what our wonderful police officers do and help them. And I just am always so grateful that someone took an opportunity and a chance on me, the 14-year-old kid that walked through the door, the kind of square peg in a round hole saying, I want to truly make a difference. Someone took a chance on me and I'm forever grateful. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be sitting on this side of the table from you today. And I definitely want to meet with our Explorers and the meetings tonight. And so I have my first meeting tonight with our Explorers.
Good.
No city is perfect, but I think most people would agree when Overland Park has a bit of a spoils of riches. It ends up in the top 10 of every year of great places in America to live. Some of the best schools in the Kansas City Metro. I believe the top 4, as we were talking about prior, at least some of them are located in the city of Overland Park. But what are the challenges that you've been made aware of or that you see for the city of Overland Park, at least in your capacity?
Sure. So I think anytime a city is growing and thriving, there's a lot of challenges and yet opportunities to really engage on. And so some of the things I would like to do is I'm really passionate about community policing and community engagement. I definitely think we are better together. And there's probably many people that have different perspectives on ways that we can improve, ways that we can do things even greater to serve our community. And I want the community to know it's their police department. And so how do I hear and get suggestions and input from them? And so I'm really looking forward to learning from our community members and from our department members on ways that we can improve our public safety.
We hear community policing all the time. We hear it on both sides of state line. What does that look like to you? What does that mean to you? Is it hiring more officers? I believe there are 300 some sworn officers in Overland Park. What does it mean?
Community policing to me really means that the police are the community and that the community are the police, that the community has a voice in what they would like to see out of their police department and suggestions. If I only make decisions as a leader and don't get input from our staff or from our community, I could inadvertently and adversely be making decisions that would negatively impact those that we're here to serve. Public safety to me is a service. I believe it is a gift, and we're here to serve our community, and we can't do that adequately, number one, if there is a lack of trust and transparency within our community, and we can't do that if people don't have a seat at the table to provide suggestions. So it's incumbent upon us to make sure people are at the table, and two, if they're not, that we're inviting everybody to the table to be able to provide their input and their suggestions for us.
The city of Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm not asking you to comment about a police department you don't lead, but the city of Kansas City, Missouri, is drastically short on the number of officers that they would like to have. I believe the number is 300 or something short of what they would like to have. As Dana mentioned, you're roughly around 300 sworn officers on staff. Are you at full capacity or do you need more?
We are currently not at full capacity. And I would say that recruiting and policing, it's a national crisis for many police departments. We are having a hard time getting people in the door. And so for me,
why?
I really like to focus on culture. I believe if we can create environments where people can thrive, inclusive environments where people have a voice, that they feel appreciated, heard, and valued within the organizations that they run, that we run, I think a lot of that would help. And so it is not lost on me that when people serve at our police department, whether in a police officer capacity, a 911 dispatcher capacity, our property and evidence records, any different capacity, they have lost holidays, they've missed out on birthdays, they've missed out on many significant events in their family's life. It is not lost on me that it takes sacrifice to do this job. And so I want to make sure that our people feel valued within our organization, that our people can thrive and do the things they would like to do. And so I focus a lot on inclusive culture within our department. And I talk about that when we look at police reform. It's truly transforming police departments from the inside out.
Police Chief Doreen Jokerst joining us in studio. If you have a question, you're welcome to text one in at 913-586-7798. Can you stick around for another segment?
Sure. That sounds great. Thank you so much.
We'll continue to visit with her in just a moment here on Dana and Parks. She recently hailed from the University of Colorado, but don't hold that against her. She is the new police chief in Overland Park, Doreen Jokerst. And she is on her third day on the job and already making time to visit with us. And, of course, through extension to you, you were the police chief for 6 years at the University of Colorado Boulder. Tell me about Deion Sanders.
So I was the police chief there at the University of Colorado Boulder for 6 years. I tell you, my life changed when we hired, from a football platform, Coach Deion Sanders. And he was wonderful. He really supported public safety. He supported police. We had a great interaction and a great relationship together in regards to it. And we worked really hard together on humanizing the badge and meeting with our student athletes. I talk about we want people to run to us for help and not away. And so that really comes with transparent conversations and for people to get to know us and feel comfortable being able to ask questions. And so that football platform did change.
Did you call him Coach Sanders or Coach Prime?
I called him Coach Prime.
Just Coach.
That's right.
Coach
yes.
Prime.
And it was funny, the first time we met, I asked him that. I said, what should I call you? And he's like, what should I call you? And I said, you can call me Doreen. And he's like, you can call me Deion. And we went with Chief and Coach.
Good.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. So let's talk a little bit about recruiting and specifically here, minority recruiting, minority hiring, retention, and women as well. I don't know what the numbers look like in Overland Park. I know departments have struggled with that across the country. Are there plans to address that? And if so, how?
Yeah, so there's a national recruitment crisis in policing. We are definitely not getting the number of applicants that we used to historically and back in the day. Our agency signed the 30 by 30 initiative, which is basically saying by 2030, we would like 30% of our commissioned staff to be female. We're currently under those numbers, which nationally many police departments are. And so we're always looking at ways that we can diversify our police force, diversify our staff. We're recruiting at different universities. We're recruiting at different HBCUs. And so we're constantly out there. And I would ask any of our listeners, if you have a want to serve intrinsically, if you want to serve our community and make it better, and you believe Overland Park is the place for you, which I believe it would be, please reach out. We'd be more than happy to have you as part of our team.
2-point question here. You mentioned a moment ago, prior to the previous break, that you thought that the the problem with recruiting was cultural.
Mm-hmm.
A, what do you mean by that? And B, is the pay that police officers make, is that also another hindrance?
I think when we look at recruitment nationally, it is going to be a myriad of different things and maybe not just one thing that you can latch onto. When I talk about cultural, historically, a lot of police departments did not treat employees well. It's, you know, it is based upon seniority, but it's almost it is a ranking structure where if someone had an opinion or idea, maybe they didn't feel comfortable that they could bring those suggestions forward because they weren't at a certain tenure within that department. And that is not at all how I feel. Everyone and everybody within our police department has a right, an opinion, and a value. And everyone is equally important, regardless of rank, position, tenure, or status. And so it's really making sure that our employees feel valued and appreciated and want to come to work. I don't want anyone to have anxiety coming to work. I want them to come to work and really feel supported and want to serve our beautiful Overland Park community. So I think that is one piece. Pay is something we're always competing with different police departments. Yeah. What does the pay look like? What incentivizes? What different ways we can incentivize our employees? And so those are things that I will be looking at and figuring out. How competitive are we? What are some neighboring jurisdictions doing that maybe we can learn from or do better? And what are other things out there? And that will come with me meeting with staff and meeting with our employees and saying, what can we do better? What can I, as your police chief, do better to make sure I'm providing you the resources, removing obstacles, so you can do your job more efficiently and effectively?
Dana asked you this off air, but I'll ask you on air. You're not required to live in the city of Overland Park as the police chief, but will you?
I currently do live in the city of Overland Park, and I'm very proud to say that Overland Park is my home. It has been such a welcoming environment for me. My family is very excited to be here, and so Overland Park actually is my home, and I'm very proud of that.
Okay. Well, welcome to town.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you
so
much.
Have you been to Oklahoma Joe's?
I have not yet. That is on the list. I heard about it today from somebody else as well, and so it's on my list to go this weekend.
Okay, we also have Q39. Thank you, Sam. There are two Oklahoma Joe's, but one is in the gas station over on County Line Road. That would be the one I would go to, and then Q39.
If anyone knows where to eat on any corner in any town, in any space in America, it's every police officer I have ever met. You, Chief, are in good hands. They will guide you where to go.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And it's definitely been some good food since I have been here.
Good.
So, yes.
Well, welcome and good luck. And don't be a stranger and don't mess with your media department. We love those guys.
Thank you.
In particular, Officer Lacey. He's our favorite.
I think that's great. We like him very much.
He is wonderful. You're just saying that because he's sitting right here. And, he's a very large, strong man.
With muscles on top of muscles.
Good to see you guys. Be well.
All right.
Thank you.
And tell Coach Prab that we said hello,
if you don't mind.
All right, quick break. The new police chief of Overland Park, Doreen Jokers, here on Dana and Parks. A follow-up to a story that captivated us on Tuesday. This is from the Associated Press. A Russian man rescued after 67 days adrift in a small inflatable boat in the Sea of Okhotsk described how he survived by battling shivering cold and drinking rainwater. Mikhail Pichigin, 46 years old, had set off to watch whales with his 49-year-old brother, 15-year-old nephew, but the boat's engine shut down on their way back on August 9th. His brother, the 49-year-old, and his nephew were both dead when rescuers found them.
He reported that they had died of starvation.
Initial efforts by emergency services to locate the trio failed. Pichugin's brother and nephew later died. Mm. He tied their bodies to the boat to prevent them from being washed away.
That's morbid. Oh, my gosh.
By the way, the boat that saved him was called Angel.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So the fact that he's still speaking to the media tells me that he has not been whisked away to a Russian gulag yet, because if you remember correctly, they said that he could be charged because his boat was only permitted to go 2 kilometers from shore.
Yeah, well, Mother Nature took care of that. It is a miracle he is alive. It is so devastating about his brother and his nephew. It's a miracle anyone survived that.
They said that he drifted 574 nautical miles.
And was 14 miles offshore when he was finally found.
Why don't we put GPS beacons on boats and rafts?
Well, this was just a little inflatable dinghy.
We have that. We have Life 360 on our phones. You can put an Apple AirTag on anything and stalk someone. You mean to tell me we're not routinely putting those on boats anymore?
Okay, here we go. They The little dinghy had a limited stockpile of noodles and peas, and he did try to catch some fish. He slept under a sleeping bag that had camel wool in it, but it was wet and never dried.
Oh, God.
That would be awful.
You also have to keep in mind that we're not talking about typical modern society here on the edges of the Serbian tundra.
Russian media quoted Pechugin as saying that his nephew died of hypothermia and hunger last month.
God.
His brother started behaving erratically and at one point tried to jump off the boat.
You would. You would lose your mind from the dehydration, Scott, from exhaustion.
Being trapped in a weird way, despite the fact that you're in the middle of wide open space, you are trapped.
Okay. Now we have a little bit more information on how long he could end up in a gulag.
For accidentally drifting further away than 2 miles? Well, give me a break.
I think he went more than 2 miles, and that's why he got in trouble. Transport investigators have launched a probe into possible breaches of safety rules, raising the prospect that Pechugin could face a criminal charge and risk a jail term. Would you care to guess what it would be in Russia?
You know what? No.
Of up to 7 years.
Good God.
7 years. Russian television reported the men should have taken a satellite phone, the only means of communication in the Sea of Okhotsk.
Yeah, you think they didn't all think that on about day three?
He said he did have a cell phone on the inflatable raft, but there was no coverage. Duh.
Did they not have an oar?
They did have an oar, but the oar broke. So the engine breaks down.
Talk about a series of unfortunate events.
Yeah, what part of the story, sir, do you realize that God doesn't really like you? I don't know when the oar broke.
Well, he did send a boat named Angel. So,
that's true. So the engine breaks down. Then they have one oar on board the boat.
Oh, God.
Or the raft.
Which means you're going in circles.
The oar, well, not if you paddle on both sides.
With one oar?
Well, you paddle this way, and then you go this way. Then you go this way, then you go that
way. Back to the exhaustion. I'd be dead in 30 seconds.
So the other oar broke, or the oar broke, and it left the boat completely uncontrollable. He did have a phone, but it was useless because there was no network coverage.
Good God.
Which tells me that, yeah, he took the boat past that 2 kilometer
sure.
point. Said they were trying to see whales.
At this point, we let bygones be bygones. Right?
Russia doesn't play that.
I know. Way. All right, off to Georgia we go. A Georgia grand jury, thankfully, has indicted both a father and son in that mass shooting at Appalachian High School several months ago. WAGATV is reporting, among other outlets, that a grand jury first indicted 14-year-old Colt Gray today on a total of 55 counts, including 4 counts of malice murder. One teacher died in that shooting, I believe, and 3 students. I'd have to go back and look. So the 14-year-old that is the accused shooter.
I thought it was 2 and 2, but okay.
Was indicted on 55 counts, all right?
Okay.
But wait for it. His father, Colin Gray, faces 29 counts, including second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and reckless conduct. They are going after him for the murders as well, and I am thrilled for it.
What specifically is dad charged with?
Oh, let me just tell you. 29 counts, second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and reckless conduct, and here is why. They're both in jail. Investigators testified that the 14-year-old carried a semi-automatic assault-style rifle on the school bus that morning with the barrel sticking out of his book bag wrapped up in a poster board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He left his second period class, came back from the bathroom, and then what we know happened. All right? Teachers Richard Aspinwall, Christina Ermey, you're correct. 2 teachers and students, Mason and Christian, both boys, 14, both died. So 4 total, 2 teachers, 2 kids. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. Both parents long had signs that Colt Gray was, quote, troubled. In fact, his dad was interviewed about an online threat in May of 2023 linked to his son. Okay?
Okay.
Investigators say at some point the child had a severe anxiety attack, and a counselor reported that he was having suicidal thoughts and rocked and shook uncontrollably while in her office. Okay. Colt's mother, you remember, did not live with them, Scott.
Right.
She told investigators she had argued with his dad, asking him to please secure his guns and restrict access to those guns from the son, who was clearly in the midst of a mental breakdown.
I believe she lived in the county that they lived in prior.
Yep. Instead, dad bought the boy ammunition, a gun sight, and other shooting accessories. Colt Gray then asked mom, please put me in a mental asylum. The teenager asked, put me in a mental asylum. I am not doing well. The plans fell apart when his parents started arguing again about his access to guns the day before. And his father made the excuse he didn't have the gas money to get him help.
I think it might be a and I'm all for charging reckless, inattentive, dumb parents with some sort of crime when their kids have easy, and they know their kid is, let's just say the elevator's not going to the top floor, and they let their kids have access to weapons when they know their kids are
in trouble.
Yeah.
Struggling
to say the least. I think a second degree murder charge against dad might be legally a bridge too far.
Why?
Even in Michigan, you may recall with the first case, yep, where the parents were charged.
Jennifer and James Crumley.
Correct. They were charged, I believe, with voluntary or involuntary manslaughter.
They were the first to be convicted in a U.S. mass shooting. Sentenced to at least 10 years in prison for not securing their firearm at home and, quote, acting indifferently to signs of their son's deteriorating mental health, yeah, before he killed four students in 2021. This idiot, dad in this case, clearly was acting indifferently and handed over the gun, ammunition, scope, and all of the other things when mom was saying, you know, in the other case, Scott, mom and dad were in tandem. In this case, mom was at least saying something is wrong. He needs help. You've got to restrict the access to your weapons. And it appears the dad said, go take a long walk off a short pier.
But just from a legal standpoint, to Scott's point, it doesn't second degree imply that he had to pull the trigger?
Well, here's what I would...
I don't think so, or they wouldn't have charged that, Sam.
Here's what I would argue regarding what they did charge, Dana, is prosecutors usually and should only charge what they think they can get a conviction on. And if I'm on that jury, I'm not convinced that you can convince me that this father engaged in second-degree murder.
But this was a grand jury that handed up this indictment. And so from here, maybe the prosecutor takes a look and says, look, now we have the indictment. We'll unseal this. This is what it says. We'll charge dad with this. The wider issue isn't, and the phones are already ringing. I'd love to hear from our parents on this and our educators. I think the wider issue is, you know, let's not necessarily get into the weeds of whether this is second degree or manslaughter, or the wider issue is the tide is starting to turn when it comes to the parents and the extreme, grotesque, irresponsible behavior when it comes to their very troubled children and firearms.
And I welcome this change. I do.
It is long overdue.
I think you and I are on the same page in... If you know that your kid, well, first of all, it doesn't matter if your kid has mental issues or not. The guns should be secured in your home. But it gets even worse when you know that your kid has some issues or some struggles or whatever, and you either don't lock up your guns, or in the case, as alleged, in this case out of Georgia, you give him more access to guns and weaponry. Clearly, this father should be charged. I'm not convinced you're going to get a jury to nail him on second degree murder.
If you look back at Columbine, and I've read Sue Klebold's book, I wish I had not. I am more educated because of it, but it's one of those books that I can't get it. I'll never be able to get it out of my head. And one of the things they said in the aftermath of that horror in Colorado was that those guns were hidden so well,
they were in a closet
ahead of time, that the ATF, think about all of the law enforcement that would have been through both of those homes. They tore those houses apart, as they should have, after the mass shooting at Columbine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Klebold calls the ATF or FBI or police 3 months later, found a gun even law enforcement had not uncovered behind a fake paneled wall in Dylan Klebold's bedroom. That is a very different scenario than the case we are talking about here, where it's my right to have a gun. I'm going to share my love of shooting with my son, even though he's begging to be committed into a mental asylum, even though he has a fascination with school shooters. I'm going to give him accessories that somehow promote what has happened here. He should go directly to prison for that.
Well, and obviously Dad's elevator doesn't go all the way to the top floor either, because he is spending...
Is he just reckless?
I'm assuming large sums of money on this gun, ammunition, sights, the whole nine. And then, I don't have any gas money to help my son.
I don't think that this is a mental issue with the dad. I think this is just extreme, reckless...
Callous.
Abandonment, callous behavior.
913-586-7798.
My ex-wife's not going to tell me what to do with my guns. That's what this is. This was a pissing match in between mom and dad.
Shane in Overland Park. Shane, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I still hard for me to talk about. I'm in my 50s, and my best friend was shot and killed in our seventh grade classroom and died in my lap. And I feel that if the parents of the shooter had have locked up their guns, my best friend would still be alive to this day. So I think the father of this child should be charged because it's his responsibility to make sure that stuff doesn't get out.
Well, no dispute that he should be charged, but should he be charged with murder?
Yep.
Okay.
I full-heartedly believe that he should be charged with murder because had he had locked this stuff up, these people wouldn't have been murdered. The child couldn't have gone out and done what he did.
And Shane, we're so sorry about the loss of your friend. I think there's two discussions here. There's the parent who doesn't lock up the gun. I don't know where the gun's at.
Mm-hmm.
Go look. Is the gun where we think it is? There's scenario A, which is reckless. And then there's this scenario. I am going to ply my child with weaponry, knowing they have mental health issues. Those are both criminal in my mind when something like this happens. They're both crimes, but they're very different, and one is way worse.
Okay. 913-586-7798. 586.
Do you disagree?
I think
it's passive recklessness versus active recklessness. The passive recklessness is I didn't lock it up.
Yeah.
But I didn't know he took it. Active recklessness is, here, take the gun. Your mom doesn't want you to have it. Have it. Here's a scope and a silencer, and what else do you want?
If you're asking me, do I think Dad's a DB? Yes, he is. But I also think he's overcharged. And your job as a prosecutor is to charge people with crimes you think you can get a conviction. And unless, and I'm talking a little bit too much inside baseball here, but you and I have been in way too many courtrooms over our careers. Unless you can charge him with second-degree murder and get a lesser included of either involuntary or voluntary manslaughter.
And those decisions will come. Now that the indictment's been handed up, those decisions will come from the DA's office and should.
Yeah.
And should.
913-586-7798. 586-7798. Sam Stevie III, Dana Wright. My name is Scott Parks here on KMBZ. We were talking with the new police chief in Overland Park earlier this hour about barbecue. She just got in town about a week and a half ago. And the world's first museum dedicated to all things barbecue will open in Kansas City at Crown Center in the spring of 2025. 4,200 square feet. The Museum of Barbecue is founded by Jonathan Bender, a longtime writer and judge at the American Royal, and Chef Alex Pope, owner and chef at the local pig. Have you ever judged a barbecue contest?
I have not. I've been at an event that was a judging for a barbecue contest.
Okay. I have been a judge twice at a barbecue contest in my neighborhood in Western Troll. And the first year, I didn't know what I was doing.
They're all served with Grey Poupon.
Of course. And a Chardonnay. But man, these guys really, when people enter into a barbecue contest, they're not playing around.
No.
That's like serious business.
You know, even when you talk about the American Royal, like, do you know how much money teams spend on the entries? Like, it's a hobby, but it's also a passion, and it's competitive, and it is not cheap.
It's time consuming. Sarah,
oh, yeah.
Sarah's boyfriend and his dad are in the American Royal Barbecue. I don't know if it's already happened or if it's coming up soon. I think it just happened. Hell, I can't remember. But they go out on Friday, you know, and of course you've got to prepare the meat for like days. And then they go out on a Friday. They don't come home until Sunday. They are camped out.
Oh, it's the whole weekend.
They're camped out at the American Royal.
By the way, coming up this year on October 31st.
Okay, so it's later this month. All right. Quoting here from Bender, Jonathan Bender, Kansas City is a natural home for the Museum of Barbecue. Barbecue is synonymous with the city because of the rich traditions here, and we're proud to bring the world's first museum dedicated to barbecue to Kansas City.
Good. I'd go see that.
Susan Smith.
No.
I'll save it for right after 4 o'clock.
Why do you do this to me?
I'm just going
to
save it for right after 4 o'clock.
I'm already mad about the dad in Georgia.
They did make an arrest in the second Betty Ray's burglary.
Good.
In the River Market.
Good. Which, by the way, we might bring this up next hour or in the 5 o'clock hour. I'm thrilled they've made an arrest in the second burglary in Betty Ray's case. There were 5 additional business robberies overnight in the River Market.
Oh.
5.
We'll get to that and much more. And a revelation from Dan Weinbaum when we return. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's doing naughty stuff. Sam Stevie III, Dana Wright. My name is Scott here on KMBZ. Don't act like it's not naughty.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.